Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 24th of October 2015. My name is Hereward Fenton and I will be your host for the next hour. And today I'm going to start off with a bit of an ad-lib section, and then I'm going to get into some important stories, some material that I think is worth discussing this week. But I want to begin by kind of making a statement, an impassioned statement, about the necessity of anyone who's begun to wake up, begun to understand that they've been deceived about so much in life, and begun to understand deeper truths about the world in which they live, to engage, and in doing so, defy the odds, because the odds are against you having much of an impact. We know that. There are so many reasons why it's logical and rational in the face of the monolithic corporatized state and the vast powers that are at play to simply sit back and think, my God, I can't do anything about this. It's like watching a tsunami approaching you. You know, you're like you're standing there on the beach and there's a 50-foot high tsunami coming. You can't outrun it. There's nothing you can do. It's kind of feels like that, right? But you know what? There are things that you can and indeed must do. And it's not really the same scenario as the 50-foot high tsunami approaching you. It feels that way, and it's been created. The theatre of your life has been created in such a way to make it look like you can't do anything about it, to make it look as if you are utterly insignificant against massive forces. And there are a whole lot of specific arguments and objections that people typically have in relation to becoming active, to engaging with the unjust, corrupt, impossibly wicked nature of the power structures that underlie modern society. And I want to just kind of run through some of them, and I want to debunk them. And this is something that we all do, we all have to do constantly in our kind of personal psychological space, because if we don't do this, we actually subconsciously, unconsciously become reconditioned. And this can happen despite a high level of awareness, despite actually knowing a lot of facts, and I've seen it among many people, that there's this tendency to kind of wake up and then just kind of hit the snooze button. And, you know, hitting the snooze button, it just feels like the most logical thing to do when you consider all the work that has to be done if you actually fully wake up, get up, and actually start doing stuff. So let me just consider a few of the very common objections people have. And these are thoughts that I've often had myself. And, you know, when I have these thoughts, it's very important to, you've got to step right back and look at the situation and look at who you are, look at the world, and you see, yes, of course, these are the types of reasons which will make me give up. And then when you see that that will induce you to give up, you realize that your giving up is actually a plus for somebody else. Every time someone gives up and loses hope and loses the will to change the world, the tyrants and the criminals chalk one up on the board. You know, it's great. It's really good for them. So let's just continue now and consider some of these very common objections that just sort of pop up in one's mind randomly. One very common one is that you don't have the skills. I mean, for example, doing a radio podcast, I've spoken to people about this and people have said, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. You know, I couldn't possibly talk to people. I don't have the skill for that. I don't have the verbal skills. I just don't have the talent for it. I can't do it. I'm not capable. And this is interesting because pretty much everyone who starts doing something like this doesn't have the skills in the beginning either. And I think my skills have improved somewhat. I've learned to be more fluid and less halting and less clumsy in the way I speak, although I'm continually working on improving that. But the skill set is important, but the skill set is something that develops as you move forward. So this idea that you don't have the skills, therefore you can't do it, is just a cop-out. It's just a cop-out. It's nothing more than that. So if you find yourself saying that to yourself, or you hear someone saying that to yourself, just remember what I'm saying now, is that everyone who did this had to learn as they went along, and most people were pretty crappy to start off with. Okay. Now, another very important objection that often raises its head is that you can't compete with the big players. And whether that means in media or politics or whatever field it is you're trying to make a difference in, everything is very corporatized these days. And every time you try to do something original, you're effectively competing with vast corporate networks that have billions of dollars in their budget to make everything super professional. And you know, even if you're good at what you do, even if you do have the skills on your own, there's a sense that you just can't compete with the vast resources that are brought to bear by the giant corporate system that we live within. Now, of course, this is a slightly more tricky objection to deal with, because it is quite true in some respects. And where I like to make my thrust on this is to say that what you can do is you can effectively, and I'll just apply it to alternative media, because that's what I'm doing, but you can do what the big players won't do. You can go where they fear to tread. You can raise issues that they ignore. And that's what we do. That's the reason, that's the main substance of this show, is that I bring up things on this show that the corporate players either will not touch or only ever cover in a completely skewed and ridiculously biased way that's obviously just propaganda. And I'll be talking about a couple of instances of that later on in today's show. And I do that every week. And it's not hard to find the material. Once you just open your mind and allow yourself to have your own thoughts in relation to what you see going on around you, allow yourself to have your own reflections and your own opinions, and suddenly you will find that you are having thoughts, perceptions, and observations which are completely ignored in the mainstream. It's incredible. And the more you focus on it, the more you realize that there's all this information that's not getting through. And that's when you realize that you actually do have something unique to offer, that you actually do have something original that actually can compete with the big players. But your main problem is always going to be reaching people. But that's another problem. But in terms of the quality of your content, of what you're actually doing, you can quite easily compete, as long as you apply yourself, you use your intellect, as long as you've got room temperature IQ or higher, you can do this, right? But you do need to be awake, you do need to be alert, you do need to have the blinkers off to see what's in front of your face. Now, another common objection. A lot of people say that they have nothing original to say. You know, I've got nothing original to say. Well, again, that's related to what I was just talking about. But it's also related to kind of a self-esteem issue, because people feel that the world out there is so big and so scary and so powerful, and that you're so small and you're just one insignificant little speck of dust. You know, how could you ever have something original to say? But the point is, everyone has something original to say. Every single person on this planet has something original to say. And at the moment, you know, with mainstream news sources and entertainment and media generally, we're just getting cartels that have prepackaged observations and viewpoints, which are dumbed down and extremely limited. So there's like a billion viewpoints which are never being put on the table. And that's part of why we're in such a mess. We've got such a limited set of concepts and a limited spectrum of things that people are actually aware of in their consciousness to make decisions about their life. Next objection, it's too time-consuming. Very common one, because we're all incredibly busy and we all have a lot of other commitments. And this is actually tied to the next one. I'll deal with them together, that there's no benefit to you, and whether that be financial or otherwise. So it's too time-consuming and there's no benefit to you. Now, this in some ways is true. Again, it's a difficult one to challenge because it is time-consuming. There's no doubt about it. And often there will be no tangible benefit to you. These are facts, but these are facts that have to be countered by your deep knowledge of how important it is, and that the benefits to you have to take second place to making some benefit for humanity, for the world, for the future. And it is a bit of a moral question. It is a bit of a question in terms of your priorities and your spiritual state of mind, to know what's important and what your orientation needs to be for the higher truths, the higher important truths and necessities of being a conscious being on this planet. Next objection I want to briefly talk about. Nobody cares about truth. Now, this is very common, to believe that nobody cares. And this is tied to another observation, that you can't change the course of history. Of course, largely because nobody really cares. The belief that nobody cares is a conditioned belief. And again, it suits the powers that be that you have this view. We are going to break. I will be right back. Stay with us. You're with Truth News Radio. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I just want to continue, finish off here with my refutations of the common objections to why you should not engage and challenge the system. And I say defy the odds, because you are going to have to defy the odds. And that's part of the problem, is that people see the odds are against them and they don't want to do it. And of course, it's an argument. It's a logical argument. But, you know, if the odds were against, the odds are against so many things. The odds were against human beings ever coming out of the trees and, you know, inventing tools and discovering fire and creating technology and being able to sail around the world and colonize new continents. The odds were against human beings every step of the way there. And the odds against those who wanted to end the slave trade in the 18th and 19th centuries in the United States were huge because there was so much power arrayed against them. And yet they did. They ended the slave trade. So many basic rights and freedoms were earned against the odds initially, and then over time it happened. So you have to look at the scope of history. And I was talking there towards the end of the last segment about... Actually, let me just cover the last few bullet points there because I had to race through them. I was talking about the view that there is no benefit to you and that engaging and challenging the system may harm your image. And these two... These two kind of work together because, of course, if there's no benefit to you, then that in itself is not a positive. But not only is there no benefit to you, it can negatively affect the way you are perceived by other people. And this, of course, is, again, a problem that you have to address deep inside yourself because you need to understand who you are. Really are, and you need to understand what your true image is rather than the social image which is given to you by peer groups. Your true image is something far greater than that, and we have to divest ourselves of this debased kind of image of what we are, you know, workers, resources within a company, just people who fulfill a function for somebody else. If that is your image of yourself, then yeah, sure, becoming any kind of renegade, becoming any kind of deviant from the social norms is going to harm your image if that's the image you really identify with. So this is absolutely crucial that you have to understand who you really are, and it's a deep journey that you've got to go on. And all I can say is go on that journey. You know, it's just please take one or two steps forward and keep going. And you'll find that the concept of what a benefit is and the concept of your image will start to evolve. And again, returning to the questions about whether people care about the truth and whether you can change the course of history. Again, this flows from who you are as a person and your strength, your inner will, your inner knowledge. That will actually make people care about the truth more. You will resonate as you start to understand the truth, and your understanding will resonate with more and more other people, and they will pick up that, and that resonance will expand. And that, my friends, is how you change the course of history. But it doesn't happen through a kind of lackluster, sort of laid-back kind of, I know all this stuff, I'm really smart, you know, I'm a cynic, but I do nothing because there's no point. That guarantee you nothing will evolve from that. Guarantee you that will be a completely dead end and you will end up feeling more and more bitter as life goes on and you see nothing change around you. But as you wake up to your inner knowledge and your inner self and your higher goals, your truth will magnify among other people, and you will start to change the course of history. That's what I believe. So I'll leave that with you to ponder. Now, in the rest of today's show, I've got to cover a couple of big topics, and I want to return to the question of copyright infringement, which I discussed briefly in the last show, but I really want to get into a deeper questions with it. I want to get into deeper philosophical questions and also legal issues so that you really understand it, because it's very easy to be bowled over by incredibly arrogant, cocky people who simply shove an idea down your throat. And I want to begin by playing a little YouTube video for you, which is titled Copyright is Not Theft. Now, this video is just a kind of a cute sort of presentation of some very, very important facts, and it's done in the form of music and a song. So I'm just starting that for you now. Copying is not theft. Here we go.
Copying is not theft. Stealing a thing leaves one less left. Copying, it makes one thing more. That's what copying's for. Copying is not theft. If I copy yours, you have it too. One for me and one for you. That's what copies can do.
There we have it, song and animation by Nina Paley, and that's on YouTube. Now, some really, really important fundamental points being made there in that little song, and I'm going to discuss that also in relation to some articles that I've found, and we'll begin with an article on Torrent Freak. TorrentFreak.com, a website which is oriented to people who like to download torrents from peer-to-peer networks using services like the Pirate Bay. Piracy is not theft. Problems of a nonsense metaphor. When talking about piracy, the entertainment industry and politicians often use the term theft. This is a huge problem, according to the Swedish sociologist of law, Stefan Larsson. In his thesis, Metaphors and Norms, Understanding Copyright Law in a Digital Society, he explains that these metaphors are in part keeping the wide gap between people's norms and the law intact. A few years ago, best-selling author Paul Coelho made a Russian translation of The Alchemist available without permission from his publisher. As a result, the sales in Russia skyrocketed from 1,000 books a year to over 1 million. The above is just one of the many examples which show that there are many positive sides to the act of copying. Despite these nuances, piracy is often referred to as theft. This is a problem, according to Stefan Larsson. Larsson addresses the issue in his thesis, Metaphors and Norms, Understanding Copyright Law in a Digital Society. For which he just received his doctorate. Talking to Torrent Freak, he explains why copyright infringement isn't theft and how this problematic metaphor keeps the gap between public norms and the law intact. We're going to break. I'll be right back after this short break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Herman Fenton. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm talking about copyright infringement and theft and the legal concepts therein, which are deeply misunderstood. Now, quoting here from Stefan Larsson, the theft metaphor is problematic in the sense that a key element of stealing is that the one stolen from loses the object, which is not the case in file sharing, since it is copied. There is no loss when something is copied, or the loss is radically different from losing something like your bike. One of the obvious problems is that it suggests that every stolen copy is a lost sale. Following this conception, some iPods could be valued at millions of dollars, and a file sharing service could aid in copyright infringements representing more than the gross domestic product of entire countries, Larsson says. And indeed, if we look at the court case against the Pirate Bay in Sweden, the remuneration model of the entertainment industry would mistakenly put the value of the site at billions of dollars. I think that one important aspect lies in that the legal regulation is built on fundamentally different concepts of reality, Larsson told Torrent Freak. The researcher explains that the public perception of the law or social norms is out of line with what the law actually says. In part, this is because the theft metaphor is built into law, while there is no such thing as theft where piracy is concerned. In other words, this means that legal concepts can become metaphorical if their meaning expands into new areas, and the fixed conceptions that once ensured their legitimacy may seem unjust in the eyes of a reality that has moved on. This supports the gap between legal and social norms regarding parts of copyright today. The gap between the law and what people see, feel, and experience in real life is a problem, one that lawmakers are now trying to address with even more draconian laws based on the same nonsense metaphors. Now, let me just pause to reflect on what he said there, that legal concepts can become metaphorical if their meaning expands into new areas. So the concept of copyright infringement, when it becomes blurred with the concept of theft, is really a blurring of the concept of theft to something that that has no connection with the meaning of the word in common law, historically going back to the beginning of time. So part of what's going on is language itself is being redefined, and you are being encouraged to apply moral injunctions to these redefined linguistic constructs, which have, you know, emotional cofactors related to them, which lead you to support a view that such an action is criminal. And of course, that then means that people effectively have been brainwashed. I mean, there's really no other way of describing it. Now, just continuing here from the article. Are tougher laws the best solution? Will these change people's norms? Larsson is not convinced. There are naturally many examples of when tougher laws change behaviour, and there are also examples of when tougher laws have made a substantial contribution in changing social norms. However, there are a few possible drawbacks when law turns repressive. He explains that these laws would need to make everyone think differently about reality, something that's easier said than done. And let me just expand on that, because it's not totally clear, I think, from what he said. Basically, what we need to to do in order to make these laws effective is to inculcate in you an idea that a certain type of action, which according to everything in your biological makeup, your instincts, and the cultural history of mankind, would say is harmless. And to say that this is actually a bad, wicked, evil thing. And I'm here talking about downloading a movie off Pirate Bay. Or sharing a movie on Pirate Bay. Two sides to that. But this is a movie that you've acquired, if you've shared it. You might have bought the DVD or you might have downloaded it yourself. And this is something that you've seen on Pirate Bay. It's being shared. Sorry, I didn't mean to say downloaded off Pirate Bay. I meant downloaded from peer-to-peer that you found through Pirate Bay. But what's happening there is that someone else has shared something with you. Now, I've actually looked into most of the laws regarding theft as it relates to information. That's like materials, plays, written materials, copyrighted materials. And in most of the laws that you'll find in Western countries, there are specific laws against making public performances where you take money. And this is, I think, something that people can relate to, where you've basically taken something without permission, and you've made a public performance of it, and you've received money. Now, it's still very technically different from theft in the common sense, but I think a lot of people, and I certainly can see why that is unfair and unjust. But that is completely different to the simple act of sharing or downloading a shared file. It's quite different, and people know that it's different. And the main thrust now of where the legal changes that are coming through as a result of the Trans-Pacific Partnership are focused on is just in this area, which most people feel intrinsically, intuitively, is quite innocent and harmless. Now, I've got another article I just want to read to you briefly, which summarises some of the talking points in this debate and how you can address it from a point of view of freedom. False statement, copying is stealing. Very commonly made, and you'll find a lot of websites talking about it, and the lackeys of the corporate industries are going to be supporting that as a view, but there are counter arguments you can make. Copying is stealing? Absolutely not. If copying were stealing, we would have no need for copyright monopoly laws, as ordinary property laws would suffice. Those define stealing. But we have separate laws for the copyright monopoly, and stealing is not defined there. Therefore, obviously, it is not stealing, neither legally, morally, nor economically, nor logically. However, it is an infringement of the copyright monopoly, but that's something completely different. It is a violation of governmentally sanctioned private monopolies. So, and this is all factually correct, and this is from a website, valkfinge.net, Talking Back Lessons, Retorts to Copying is Stealing. Now, with the changes to law that are presaged by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, copyright infringement will be criminalised. But even according to the statutes that I've read, according to the parts of that document that I have read, it still seems to me the criminalisation of it is limited to copying and selling for profit. That is my understanding of it. And so most of this is talk, most of this is colour of law. But it is designed to change your moral compass. And if they succeed, then at a later date, they may be able to completely criminalise this type of activity. I'm going to have to move on from this topic now because I've got something important to discuss in the next section. You're with Truth News Radio. Stay with us.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying, something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and my name is Harry Wood Fenton. It's a great pleasure to be with you today. And do check out the website if you're interested in the show. Become a subscriber if you would like, and get a T-shirt and make a contribution to what I'm doing, because I'm really keen to continue with this, and I'm not going to be bowed down, and I'm not going to allow the cognitive dissonance and the feelings of one's minute, minuscule worthlessness in relation to the vast corporate powers that be get me down. I'm just going to keep on keeping on. I want to turn now to another very important topic, one that I want to spend a lot more time on, must do a whole show on it soon. I want to talk about biofuels. I want to talk about the palm oil plantation crisis in Indonesia. And I want to do that in the context of a deep understanding of what is really going on here. Because Indonesia has now announced, in 2015, has announced subsidies for its palm oil industry. And it is basically subsidizing biofuel. Indonesia has promoted biofuel use to help absorb rising supplies of the world's most traded cooking oil and to cut carbon emissions. The country boosted the mandated amount of palm blending in diesel to 10% from 7.5% in 2013 and ordered power plants to mix 20% in 2014. Now, notice they said in there, and that was from Bloomberg.com in April this year, to cut carbon emissions, right? Now, there's a whole swathe of other articles that have popped up recently. Southeast Asian haze strikes the Pacific as fires exceed greenhouse gas output of the U.S., Indonesia's forest and agricultural fires cloaking Southeast Asia in acrid haze are spewing more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere each day than all United States economic activity, according to an environmental watchdog, and that's from the ABC. Now, right now, Singapore, Malaysia, and a number of Pacific regions, including the Philippines, are affected by haze from Indonesia, and it is very serious. I mean, very serious health concerns from the haze. But what's more important is to understand that the arguments that are used for this, namely in relation to carbon emissions, are completely false and ludicrous. But they continue to be made. And you saw there from Bloomberg, that was a report just from earlier this year, despite dozens of reports going back many years that show that that biofuels production results in tremendous pollution problems and more carbon emissions. Now, as a carbon dioxide skeptic in relation to climate change, I'm not particularly concerned about the carbon dioxide emissions, but I am concerned about pollution. And there is absolutely no doubt that these biofuel plantations create tremendous pollution problems, and that is caused by burning off. There's a constant cycle of growing and burning off. And these plantations are now in regions which were previously a dense tropical rainforest, and they have thick peat in the soil, which is very combustible. And when that burns, it just puts out a massive amount of smoke, and it's very toxic and it's very, very dangerous. But the justification for all this has been from the beginning. And you know, since we saw the resurgence of biofuels from around about the turn of the 21st century, it has been constantly the refrain that biofuels are a way of lowering the carbon footprint, of reducing carbon emissions. And I've got another article here that I'll read to you. And this is from carbonneutralearth.com, an environmental site promoting the use of biofuels. Biofuels, a way to reduce your carbon footprint. Biofuels are fuels that are produced from biological sources, such as trees, plants, or microorganisms. They are carbon neutral because they do not result in fossil carbon being released into the atmosphere. All of the carbon contained in a biofuel was absorbed from the atmosphere by photosynthesis in plants just a few months or years earlier. This means that when you burn a biofuel, you simply release the carbon back into the atmosphere and have no overall effect on atmospheric CO2 levels. In contrast, fossil fuels contain carbon that has been locked up underground for millions of years. Burning a fossil fuel increases the level of CO2 in the atmosphere, but it is not balanced out by photosynthesis. The three biofuels which are most widely used are bioethanol, biodiesel, and wood. Well, you know, that information in there is countered by dozens of reports and research that shows that biofuel, it's burning up stored carbon in the form of the peat that's in the soil that's been locked up in there for hundreds or thousands of years. It's a nonsense in itself. But it's a nonsense that has facilitated the development of the biofuel industry. I mean, I have here another article from the European Commission. This is directly from the European Commission. Biofuels are liquid or gaseous transport fuels, such as biodiesel and bioethanol, which are made from biomass. They serve as a renewable alternative to fossil fuels in the EU's transport sector, helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve EU's security of supply. By 2020, the EU aims to have 10% of the transport fuel of every EU country come from renewable sources such as biofuels. Fuel suppliers are also required to reduce the greenhouse gas intensity of the EU fuel mix by 6% by 2020 in comparison to 2010. So despite all this information coming out about the terrible effects of biofuels, and another very important problem with biofuels is the way in which biofuels have supplanted food crops and threaten the world's food supply by using prime agricultural land to produce fuel. Now, this year, Europe has decided to limit the amount of palm oil used in biofuels. But at the same time as doing that, they are still promoting the idea of biofuels as a positive thing, because it's carbon neutral. But it does say here that after a long-running dispute between the industry and environmental groups, members of the European Parliament's Environmental Committee agreed to limit the use of food crops to 6% of the EU's 10% renewable transport energy target for 2020. Now, that's a little different to the statement I read earlier, where it said fuel suppliers are required to reduce the greenhouse gas intensity of the EU fuel mix by 6% by 2020 in comparison to 2012. Just compare those two statements. Fuel suppliers are required to reduce the greenhouse gas intensity of the EU fuel mix. Now, what that means in practice is increasing the percentage of biofuel, right, by 6%. And over here in this other article I've got from The Guardian, it says the European Parliament agreed to limit the use of food crops to 6% of the EU's 10% renewable transport energy target for 2020. On the one hand, they're actually trying to increase the use of biofuels, but then they're saying they're trying to limit the use of food crops. It is hard to really understand. I think that is actually in relation to soybeans. I think it is actually in relation to soybeans, and it is not in relation to palm oil. That's the point. They're actually saying that anyway, it's a very confusing scenario there. Now, I'd like to just point out that in Australia, we have mandates. Most Western countries have biofuel mandates, which state that I think it's 10% of fuel must be biofuel. There is an ongoing crisis in Indonesia because of the environmental degradation, because of the dispossession of people from their lands by these vast palm oil plantations and by the pollution that is caused. And it's all being still facilitated by the completely bankrupt meme that we have to reduce carbon emissions, which is itself faulty and completely incorrect when applied to biofuels. I hope you found today's show worthwhile. We will be back next week with more of the same. I hope to get into a lot of these topics in more depth in coming shows. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out. Thank you.